This is side two. When the tape ended, we were talking about Dr. Geyer's relationship with President Hanna.
Wait, Jeff, you got to realize that when I started, the university was relatively small. And John had the ability to keep his finger on just about everything that was happening. He knew just about every faculty, I think. And you'd see him wherever, and he'd say, how's that pesticide work going? What's the latest developments with these critters that are dying off? Mm-hmm. He always had he just seemed to be in the right place at the right time. And he seemed to be, he was always interested in what was happening agriculturally. He never drifted away from the fact that we were a land-grant institution. Mm-hmm. I hope we never do. I think sometimes we're sneaking away from it a little bit too far right present, or, in the last decade. But mm-hmm. but that's what made this university, the fact that we were close to people. Mm-hmm. And, I said one of the greatest accomplishments of John Hanna was his wisdom. Well, of course, as we discussed, getting us into the Big Ten academically and athletically. But the next one that was so creative that most people never think about, and I don't know, it doesn't get much visibility, but when we got, we wouldn't have had the medical schools if we hadn't gotten in the Big Ten, mm-hmm. in my estimation. And secondly, I can remember all of the discussion about, a hospital. And he put his foot down and he said, no. We're not going to have a hospital. One, it's too costly, and two, we're a land-grant institution. We want to serve the people. We're going to do our work out. So we made partnerships. First, he made a decision that we were going to do your primary care. Well, that was the smartest thing he ever did, mm-hmm. because at the U of M, and he said, we'll turn out primary care physicians, and we'll let others specialize in heart surgery and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go out into communities in the UP, at Escanaba and Marquette, and we'll do Flint, and we'll do Grand Rapids, and we'll train our doctors there, which put us as a land-grant institution. And fortunately, we haven't drifted away from that. We take great pride. In fact, I see that just recently this year, we're number 8th in the country and 9th in producing primary care physicians, mm-hmm. quality. And, of course, the osteopathic folks have always been primary care oriented. And right now we're short of primary care. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you a story that was probably the most fun I had were these little minuets I always had a good relationship with the folks at the U of M, but from my other days, Jack Breslin was a master, and I learned from him, and we had, and everybody said, when I took over vice president, Jesus, I wouldn't take that. You're right there under the capitol. Well, I knew that was an asset, not a liability. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that today the U of M have really realized that, but it is, I can assure you. Mm-hmm. If you use it right, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we went, you spoke about the 60s. They had the gosh damn state news before they ever went to work. Mm-hmm. And all the nonsense out here, they were translating, and it was tough. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you're here where you were on a parade yesterday, they want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. You just make sure you do it right.
Or they wanted basketball tickets.
You bet your boots. You bet. And they got them. But the interesting thing, Duderstadt was president when I was president, and he was a great guy. And very intelligent, but he, as a lot of folks there, they never had to really realize the public relations skills that were necessary, I think, because they were such a distinguished institution. So I said to him, as long as I'm president, I said, we're not going to have any problems. I said, we'll be partners. I said, except for one day on the gridiron, that's it. And then
there were limits.
I said, especially in medicine, I said, because we're much better. And Nick got all red, and before he got all excited, I said, now don't misunderstand me. I said, I mean in turning out primary care, land-grant traditional medicine. Mm-hmm. And I said, we'll turn out the primary care physicians that serve the citizens of Michigan out there, and you turn out the heart surgeons, mm-hmm. and we'll just go together. Mm-hmm. So the first budget hearing, he said, you know, the nice thing about MSU, Michigan State, he said, is that we're working together as real partners, he said. They turn out, take medicine, for instance, they turn out primary care physicians and we turn out the
surgeons.
You know, so Norm and I lived over there in the president's house, and I'd come home late in the evening from the office, and the kids were out there with a band, you know, and so I'd go out and unwind and visit with them, and so I went down to the game that year was at the U of M, and he and I had been interviewed by WJR, and we were coming up the tunnel before the game, and we went by the Michigan band, and wasn't a bit of nobody recognized us, and went by the Michigan State band, and all those kids that I kidded with every night. They said, they hollered and blew their horns and tuned. He said, what the world is this? And I said, I know every one of them. And I don't think to this day he realized I was pulling his leg, but it worked out fine.
How'd we do that year?
That's the year we won in the end zone with a questionable call.
Oh, the right call.
Yeah, right call. Yeah.
We'll go back to, we're up to about 1973. Yeah. And you, at that time, became...
Director of Extension. Associate Dean and Director of Extension.
Okay. Cooperative Extension Service.
Yeah.
Who was Dean of Ag?
Larry Boger.
Okay.
And that's an interesting story, too. Mm-hmm. Of course, I knew Larry real well from my entomology, and we were chairman together, and then he moved into Dean. And I had gotten, and that's another story, but part of the HANA tradition, you know, of international involvement. And I was right along in the periods of years in the 50s and 60s when John, and everybody realized that one of his big trump cards was his faculty being involved in international, particularly agriculture. And, you know, we had people all over the world and outstanding people, and we were head and shoulders above anybody else. And so anyhow, I'd gotten really involved. I'd helped build pesticide research centers in Brazil and Egypt, and I traveled to China two or three times, and I was relatively young, and you know, I was really probably 30% of my time in international entomology, and so I was in Africa working on the weaver bird Quella Quella, and it's the biggest pest of Europe. You think that the grasshoppers, the cicadas, are, but it's not, and that was a pesticide-related project because they were using parathion, a really toxic phosphate, and they'd spray in the jungle. Once a year, these quellas nest look just like an oriole, a pretty little bird, and they'd spray those from the air in the jungle, and they had dead lions and they had dead natives and so forth. And so anyhow, they were looking for internationally another treatment. And so I was over there for a month, and it was kind of a challenge because that was one of the periods in the history of Africa that was droughty, a lot of deaths. And anyway, I got a call from Larry, and he said, we want you to be extension director. I said, Larry, I'm not even a candidate. I said, I'm having too much fun. I said, there's no way I want to do that. I said, I just love entomology, and I don't want that. And he said, well, I want to talk to you. And I said, and they were recruiting, and they had a list. And I said, when I left, I said, I'm not even on the list, and I don't want it. So then I guess that was in Nigeria.
But you were in Nigeria at the time.
And
when you
then
got
I got to Sudan, or I don't remember exactly where. I had another phone call. So I got back to United Nations, and there was a phone message, and so he called me again, and I said, Larry, I just not. I said, he said, well, I'll see you. So I got home, and he was waiting at the airport for me. And you know, Larry was a heck of a guy, and he was a great dean, and he kept twisting my arm, and it was just impossible to say no. Well, and I don't regret it. I did. You know, you wonder what your life would have been like because I was right at the peak of my research and entomology career, and yet I that moved me over into administration. And mm-hmm. I taught a little more, but you can't teach and do those kinds of things. But we had a heck of an extension service, I'll tell you. We, I don't think the institution ever had better employees in extension than mm-hmm. we had at that time.
So at the beginning, when you became director, how would you assess what were there any special problems or challenges that you had to face right in 1973?
Not really, because we had such competent county directors
okay.
and mature leadership in extension, folks that everybody loved out there, and so it was easy to see you were recruiting money from three ways. That was a big part of my responsibility, but you got the federal budget. And we started a program where I forget what we called it, but we started in Michigan. It moved to the Midwest and finally nationally, but lay leaders. And we'd take these lay leaders to Washington, but we'd take 8 or 10 of our selected ag leadership and go down there and twist their arms a little bit on our budget, and usually it was 100% successful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last 10 years, they've had nothing but trouble, and the budget's been very disastrous. But so we had a good federal budget. There was no problems. We started where we got every state legislator into the county and made him visible with some of our programs. And, of course, when it come up for a vote on the state, we did really well. We were getting more money than the university in the general fund. And then the county money, I had these directors, and we had some sessions on how to get the local folks involved. And, shoot, we had... So. My big job was to keep the institution healthy financially, and it was a lot easier than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had money coming in from the three different ways, and the three legs of the stool were, you know, really quite equal. Now the county's put in a lot more than their share, and the feds put on a lot less than their share, which is it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that ability to... how things fell into place in terms of fundraising?
Oh,
because
yeah, because
the mid-70s were kind of a tough economic time.
It was just that I fell into the right. I'd had so much involvement with the public, and I knew that the way to a politician's heart was through his vote, and his vote comes from the local people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if we wanted money for MSU, we wanted to see him visible with MSU projects out there. And it worked, mm-hmm. and the U of M could never understand that. I love the institution, but they never understood that. If I'd had stiff competition, and of course other schools like Grand Valley and Saginaw Valley, and the only one that was really very competitive was Northern, and that was because Jacob Eddy was there. And I got a friendship with Jacob Eddy in a variety of ways, and even one, I'll tell you this story to show you what. Old Jake he loved Michigan State, and part of it was Biggie and Perlis took care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if you ever remember, but every once in a while you'd see Jacob Eddy come out on the basketball field with the team.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were doing something upgrading Sparty, he said, he called me and he said, "You need some money?" I said, "For what, representative?" And he was so damn powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "For upgrading Sparty." I said, "Well, yeah, we are upgrading it." And so he said, "Well, I'll take care of that." So next thing I knew, here come a check for $10,000. I don't know where it came from, but it was from state government. And we used it to upgrade the party.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fun time for me, because it was nothing of rocket science, but it was just realizing that people make the difference. And the Lambgon Institution had the right philosophy. I guess I learned it from John Hanna.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say, once we forget that, we'll be another Grand Valley or another institution where you're all competing for the same buck. We sort of competed for a different dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's paid off. And a lot of those have got presidents now. Look at how fast Grand Valley's grown. They've got a pretty shrewd president. He's moved out mm-hmm. the land grant tradition into Grand Rapids and mm-hmm. various places. He's developed a Great Lakes Institute, and all the things that we did 50, 60 years ago.
What, you were Cooperative Extension Director when the PVB problem developed?
Yeah.
Did that raise any special problem for you as director?
Yeah, except we were sort of the pipeline of information and working out the details. The real conflict there was between the Department of Agriculture and the Department, and to some degree the Department of Natural Resources, mm-hmm. but primarily between agriculture and the public, the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And of course it was more of a matter of how to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And of course our folks did a world of basic things to send some right signals, and of course everybody with the hysteria was sufficient that we probably overreacted, and we buried all those cows, and along with it the PPB, we probably only buried a little tiny amount. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's there was so much hysteria, nobody knew the medical implications, and mm-hmm. everybody saw cancer coming and all kinds of human relationships, because some of those farm families were drinking that milk and had huge amounts of PPB in them. But it's proven that it wasn't a good thing, but there wasn't the human catastrophe that some thought it could be.
Mm-hmm. Are we better prepared now,
as a result of it? Yeah, I think so. I think, well, you got so much more data on chemicals of both those that are part of our natural environment and those are part of agriculture. And of course, we probably the greatest change in this whole state has been the changes in agriculture during this half a century that I've been involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've seen the rise and you've seen the decline of the use of chemicals. You've seen the tremendous rise in numbers of farmers, and now the tremendous decline and the huge increase in size of farms. I mean, right now you're probably seeing the most consolidation in the history of the state. And that's fascinating. You know, who would have ever thought when I started, and I worked a lot with dairy animals in the first DDT, you might have a 20 to, and if you had a 75 or 100 cow herd, family herd, mm-hmm. you were a big operator.
Yeah.
Well, today a 75 or 100 cow dairy herd can't support a family, mm-hmm. and you're looking right this morning, probably somebody just bought a farm, and he'll go to his minimum will be 1,000, and we've got some 3,000 and 4,000 cow herds, and 3 years ago we probably had 3, and I guess probably we've got 10, 11 now. Yep. 1,000 cow herds.
Yep. My grandfather was a dairy farmer in Mecosta County.
Oh, really?
And he had 26 Guernsey.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Nobody wants Guernseys now because they give such quality milk.
Fat, yeah.
Nobody wants that fat milk.
He kept them going in the Depression, though.
You betcha.
Creamy check.
You betcha.
The thing that kept
you
them
bet.
Going. And then my sister is married to a dairy farmer in the same county, and they've got they're milking 250, exactly.
Well, and of course the other big changes have been in this whole problem of land use,
loss of
I say it's important to farming, but it's more important to the state in general, tourism and recreation, because if you look at where I bet this census will really show this, but the last census, the big counties of expansion, where the percentage of increase was the greatest, are ones like Ross Common and so forth, where people are getting out of Saginaw and Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of the problems, and that's serious, of going all the way from Detroit to Saginaw with almost a solid people now.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't raise many crops or have much recreation or wildlife in that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're moving out where they can buy a 10-acre chunk, and every time you cut up a 40 into 10 acres, up there you're cutting up forestry, which is important to us, or you're cutting up somebody's potato field or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not going to be the one that'll solve it, and I don't see any solution on the drawing board, but But, you know, every politician talks it. Nobody's got an answer.
Did you get involved in any of the, in cooperative extension, where any of those issues come up with state parks and tourism? Were there?
Oh, yeah. But we were always compatible.
Okay.
And the state still is, because, you see, that was about the time, I don't remember which years it was, but we started a wine program here at the university, and one guy has sort of brought us prominence there, Stan Howell. But, you know, that fit in well with tourism. And now we're, you know, I probably got, you know, look behind you, the only office in the university that's got a bar. And those are all wines that, that when I was a director of Ag, we won national recognition for the quality of the wine. And
is that some of the Leelanau orchards?
Yes, yeah.
Fen Valley?
Both, both of those are up there. Uh-huh. And so, you know, agriculture took advantage of the farm markets, the U-picks, and not as much as we should have. Mm-hmm. But ag and tourism fits well, mm-hmm. because if you're going to have a long-term quality tourism, you got to have some open space and some quality environment, and everything can't be built up. But it scares me what the state might look like in another 50 years. And, you know, I've got a lot of interest in the UP. I love the country and got quite a little property up there. And I see the same thing happening. Mm-hmm. The prices of real estate and so forth are just going sky high. Mm-hmm. And people are cutting it up into, instead of lots up there, it's 40s and 20s. And
What part of the UP do you have?
I'm over by Crystal Falls. Okay. And, of course, I get more competition from Wisconsin than I do from Michigan. But I tell you, this is, in my estimation, it's the number one problem without a solution that presently affects
land use.
Land use. Mm-hmm. It affects agriculture, it affects the quality of life, it affects tourism, and certainly recreation. And the problem is it sneaks up on you. Mm-hmm. And people...
All that fertilizer going into the lake, what's it do to you?
That you can get, we've got pretty good control of. Mm-hmm. The problem is just cutting it up for, rather than concentrating people. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was a blue-collared worker, and that's what's happened, and you retire with a respectable retirement now, and it's cheaper for that family can migrate to Roscommon or Antrim or Alpena County and get a 40 and have a nice home and live so much more cheaply, and then have a nicer environment than he could. Certainly on the outskirts of Detroit or Flint.
Macomb County or the prices
are. Yeah, you got her. You got her. And so anyhow.
Did you have any, thanks, good coffee.
Thank you.
Did you have any contacts with presidents of the nation, not just the university?
Well, I got.
President Nixon, President Ford, Johnson?
No, I never. I did Carter.
Uh-huh.
They had a fascinating experience with Carter when I was director of DNR. I got a call from one of my staff, and he said, I want to see you. And he ran the Pigeon River place up there by Roscommon. And I said, Director, what do you think about us hosting Mr. Carter? Completely confidential, and I won't go into all the details. He loves the outdoors, and he wants to come with a couple of his hunting pals and hunt grouse, rough grouse, partridge. And I said, I don't see anything. And he said, you know, he doesn't want to go into a commercial place. And I said, I don't see anything wrong with that. So I said, go ahead. So then I got a call, and he said, Mr. Carter would like to have you have dinner with him while he's there. So he said, we'll have a steak cookout. So you know me and my love for hunting. I was up in the Upper Peninsula with my son and before that. And so I said, okay, we'll be there. And I said, my son will be with me and another fellow. And so we were having really good luck up there. And he said, I want to hunt a little bit in the morning. And he said, I said, okay. So we got a bunch of birds and we had to clean them. And we started and it was nasty. And I won't go into all the details, but I was driving, they were sleeping. I come across two and I noticed the car wasn't running right. And then I realized that the power was getting down, the battery. And make a long story short, we got about to Engadine or somewhere along there, and I finally pulled in and it stopped. There was no power left, so the guy charged the battery. And so then we were getting close to time, and we got to across the straits, and I said, well, we got to get a motel. It's not going to go clear to Indian River where we had another car. So, and if you put the lights on, I knew the battery was going to go right down. So my son said, oh, I want, he said, let's find a way to do it. He said, Dad, he said, if we'll get right behind one of these ultra vehicles with the lights on, mm-hmm. and I'll drive and with the lights off. Mm-hmm. And I said, Jesus, Dad, and go to Indian River. And he, so make a long story short, by God, we pulled off the freeway, took a flashlight and got out the park, changed cars. I left that there. And we went on down until we were 2 hours late. Mm-hmm. It was just about 8:45. Mm-hmm. And we pulled in the Pigeon River and it was, you know, it was dark and I figured it'd be some Secret Service folks around. And mm-hmm. so I introduced myself and they said, oh yeah, I said, the president's looking for you. And I said, well, we had a challenge. And I said, there's no way we could call you. So they said, well, we're just taking the stakes off. Mm. So anyhow, we sit around this big table, and of course my son's eyeballs just roll. And my son now is an associate professor over here in engineering. But anyhow, that was quite an experience. And mm-hmm. and he hunted 2 or 3 days there with us. And nobody ever knew he was in the state till he started back to Detroit, and he stopped at a Wendy's and get a lunch, and somebody recognized him.
That's interesting.
But yes, I did when I was extension director. I have to remember. We took kids to the White House a couple of times when we had special things. So, you know, it was a extension gave you all kinds of
visibility. What about in working with other presidents besides Dr. Hanna you've mentioned? Where let's talk a little bit about Walter Adams. Did mm-hmm. you have any, even though his tenure in office was relatively short?
Yeah. Walter and I were always dear friends, and I didn't have as much interaction with him when he was president. I would just go in my direction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after he and I both sort of wound down, we were close friends. Mm-hmm. I always liked Wharton very much. Wharton was here in a tough time, and I still say he handled it really well. And I've kept track of the Whartons ever since then because I like them as true friends. Mm-hmm. Well, we've had some interesting presidents.
Cecil Mackey?
Yeah, okay. Cecil and I, too, that's interesting. We seem to get closer and the more the years pass by. But, yeah, mm-hmm. Cecil and I have been, and, you know, each of them made an important contribution at a unique time. Wharton, it would have been tough on anybody, mm-hmm. including Hanna. Yeah.
What were the key issues, or the tough issues during his presidency?
Well, it was, you know, the students were so intense on environmental issues and national concerns, and they were, you know, that was the period when activism was at its peak, and the campus was alive with it. And
would you say he was the right man at the right time?
Yeah, I think so. Probably didn't get enough credit for what he did, mm-hmm. and you know, being a minority president, that was a unique feature too.
Mm-hmm. At a major university,
there's a lot of people that couldn't quite accept that, but mm-hmm. and he was quite a scholar, mm-hmm. and but those that knew him, I think realized that he provided an important transition at a time when it might have been very difficult for anybody else, but. So did Waller, mm-hmm. and then I remember well about, because I was, what I was doing when Cecil was hired, but you know, they had all kinds of troubles with recruitment, and they'd gone through a lot of names and a lot of people, and they weren't getting anywhere, and then his name floated up all at once, and I think it's, as it happens a lot of times, the decision was made fairly rapidly, because they were beginning to be, the trustees were beginning to be looked at as, well, why don't you make a decision? And so he was there at Texas Tech, and he was here quick. And sort of the same thing happened with Peter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd gone through everything, and I won't go into all the detail, but I was over there, and I wasn't anxious to stay on any longer than I had to.
And you took office in September of 92?
I think that's when it was. Okay. I can't remember, but you know.
How long did you serve as
president? A little over a year.
Okay.
And I said, I'd sure hope you could get it wound up in a year. Well, they'd gone through an awful lot of names, and they'd passed over.